Dr. Wagner, take it away.
Sounds great. Thank you, Rob, and thank you all for coming. And as Rob mentioned, Liam is here. If you enter questions into the Q&A as we go, Liam will either answer them or interrupt me if they're just questions that I can easily clarify. And then we'll hold the bigger discussion questions for the end, if you don't mind. So this is a team effort here. We've got a fabulous team. Liam is part of that team. We also have Anna and Forrest, Marion, who's an assistant professor in economics at UCI, and the rest of the team here from Herc, as you can see, Elizabeth and Laura. So just to acknowledge that this is coming through two grant fundings, we have no conflict of interest, and I'll get into some topics. I usually brush by the disclaimer because you'll hear that a lot, but I get into some topics later on, and I really want to stress that this disclaimer today. Really, these are mine alone and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. government or the VA, just to make that very clear at the outset. And I have to say that what we're trying to do here is understand what we think of as an interesting question, and I'll get to that, but I just sort of want to preface it with a little bit of background and history on access. And you know, we think of access as being the predominant feature that is defining veterans' healthcare right now and what the VA is trying to do, but VA has always grappled with providing veterans access to care. And if you go back to before any of us were alive into the 1940s, VA decided to build hospitals, and it co-located many of those hospitals next to academic medical centers with the idea that it was going to integrate clinical care, academic medicine and teaching, and research, and trying to do all three things. But implicitly, once you do that, it creates facilities where veterans had priority and services, but there are trade-offs because it fixes those assets. Those hospitals are now fixed, and those don't always match the demand, especially if you think about changing populations, changing needs, changing technologies. So we built the most recent hospital in 2012, which excludes the New Orleans hospital, which was rebuilt after Katrina. So Las Vegas was the newest one. So, but we're always, you know, grappling because there's been this strong progression of population, as you can see here on this slide. So on the left-hand side, these are obviously maps of the U.S. from the census, you get to see what was population density in the 1940s, the orange being more dense population. So I've highlighted in a red circle sort of the Michigan, Cleveland, very dense area, not sort of upstate Ohio. But you get to see sort of, and then and take a look at Florida in the 1940s and Texas and California. Vegas didn't exist then. I mean, obviously it existed as a city, but not as a major metro area. Even Denver was relatively small. And then fast forward to the right-hand side and you get 2010, you get these major population shifts. Obviously you've got air conditioning that is a huge player in these, and you can have people living and thriving in Tucson, Arizona, where it would have been much harder years ago. So those have really changed our population. Obviously you can't just pick up VA facilities and move them. And we've got facilities that may have existed sort of where our old population densities are, but are less true today. This really does create trade-offs. There's tensions about where should VA invest its money? Should it invest it in primary care, specialty care? Should it invest it in in-person care? That's really taken a change now with COVID and virtual care. There's been a lot of investments in virtual care. But then you also have the questions of, should we be building new facilities? Should we be buying more care? What kind of facilities should we produce? Should we make mobile medical units or should they be outpatient clinics? And as all of you know, especially those who have been around the VA for a couple of years, this trade-off came to a head in 2014, which became known as the Access Scandal. So here is a map. This was from the American Legion to give them credit. But on the left-hand column is number one, and it's the Phoenix, Arizona, and that was sort of the epicenter of this. And the press really took hold of this. There was a lot of discussions about sort of these waiting times, long waiting times, and suggestions that up to 35 veterans died while waiting for care. And the implication of those mortalities is that it was causally related to their care. That mortality effect is going to come into importance later on when we talk about evidence. So I just want to sort of put a point in that one or pin in that one. But you can see elsewhere, there's a lot of issues that also came up as a result of these sort of investigations that went on. Just to highlight the response from VA, Shinseki resigned. He was the secretary at the time. Congress quickly stepped in and they passed a bill known now as the Choice Act, which was $15 billion over the course of three fiscal years. And five of those $1 billion went to expand VA clinics. They did things like Saturday times. So a lot of clinics stayed open later. They had Saturday hours. And then they increased the amount of money that was being spent on what we think of now as community care or VA purchased care. That funding was supposed to run out in 2017. It ran out in 2018. But Congress and Trump then passed the Mission Act to continue and in very much ways expand the community care program. So since 2014, policymakers in DC have been focused almost exclusively on this issue of access and making sure that veterans have access. We've talked a little bit about the Choice Act and the Mission Act, but in thinking about it, you can think about four bills that really had an effect on access. One, first being the Choice Act, which I mentioned, the Mission Act, and let me just sort of highlight each of these because they have different criteria that are important. So the Choice Program or Choice Act was 2015 to 2019. You are eligible if you had to wait longer than wait time longer than 30 days, or if you lived more than 40 miles from a VA facility. The Mission Act changed that and expanded a little bit. You can see that we've moved from distance in miles to drive time. And so for primary care and mental health, it becomes a 30 minutes, so a little bit shorter. Of course, where density is, that means more people. And then a 60-minute drive time for specialty care. There's been two other acts that really changed also eligibility. One is the Compact Act. This is for veterans who are or present in acute psychiatric distress. And it says that VA is responsible for all veterans, and these veterans can present whether at a VA hospital or non-VA. And even if they're not enrolled, so not just honorably discharged, VA is responsible for them, and so it has to cover their care. And then there's the most recent one that most people are familiar with, which is the PACT Act, which is toxic exposures. I won't be talking as much about the Compact Act or the PACT Act. The Compact Act will come in a little bit later, but we'll be talking mostly about sort of these Choice Program and Mission Act issues. I should say this issue is not done yet. So if you've been following Congress, Tester from Montana introduced a comprehensive bill to expand it further. So one of the challenges you have when you focus laser-like on wait times and access is, what is the right wait time? And there is, I mean, most of us, when we're getting care, have to wait. And so it's not clear what is a perfect wait time, but reducing it seems like one of the challenges and foci of that bill. At the same time, a red team recently published a serious warning. The report on this hasn't come out yet. This includes a number of former undersecretaries of health as well as Ken Kaiser, who is one of those. And you can see that link there and you can read the link. But they said the increasing number of veterans referred to community providers threatened to materially erode the VA's direct care system. So right away, you can feel this tension. On one hand, you've got some in Congress saying, we need more purchase care authority. And then others saying, wait a second, perhaps we've gone too far. And if we do so, we're going to lose sort of this ability to provide care itself as a VA system. So let me just sort of spend a few minutes to review what we think of as being the current state of evidence, and then I'll get into the survey data that we pulled together. So Liam and our team used regression discontinuity, which is a causal inference method to evaluate the Choice Act. One of the benefits of using regression discontinuity is that it gets at causal inference in a way that you can say that the Choice Act caused something versus not. So there's nothing different between someone who lives 41 miles away from a VA versus 39, but the people who live 41 miles away are now eligible for VA purchase care. So on this graph, you have zero, which is the 40-mile threshold, so it's sort of where you are relative to that. If you're negative on that x-axis, it means you live closer, you're not eligible for the purchase care. If you live positive, you are eligible. And you get to see the Choice Act visits increase. The VA visits on total, which is a yellow line, does not increase, but all visits increase. And it doesn't look like a huge amount, but 3% is still quite large. So let me just sort of put a pin in that. What we also then did with, and this is Laura on our team, sort of was interested in the surgical care, very similar story here. You know, the x-axis is a little bit different. We have it on sort of the natural level versus recentered around zero, but you can see right at 40 miles, there is this jump up, this discontinuity, and that's exactly what this causal inference method does. So we get to see this increase in surgical care, outpatient surgical care. So this is not just us. So Gene Yoon, who's a colleague here, used different methods, but came up with very similar results. So they were trying to look at the hospitalizations between VA and VA paid community. And they see that in the post-VE veteran choice period, that the VAP community went up considerably. And so they also were looking at Medicaid expansion. We won't talk as much about that. But again, you can see the citation at the bottom of the page for that paper in JAMA Health Forum. We also know that spending increased markedly over the past 10 years, and specifically on purchased care. So in 2010, if you go back to about that time, you can see that VA spent about $10 billion, depending on how you count it. Some estimates might be closer to $8 billion. And by 2023, VA spent over $26 billion. What we're seeing this year is a continued rise, and it's nonlinear. So right now, the president's budget included $33 billion for purchased care. And what they're estimating is that we're going to surpass that. So that's a lot of money going into purchased care. The Congressional Budget Office also recently released a report that reflected on military compensation, and this is compensation that's going to people who are either in DOD or people who are in VA, and noted that VA is actually the lion's share of money that is for compensation for employees or retirees or veterans. And so since 2020, they say, the total budget for military compensation has been rising steadily, even though the number of military personnel and veterans has been declining. And spending for VA has accounted for most of that increase. So this is a real challenge for a system. It's not just VA, I should note. The US healthcare system costs are increasing rapidly, but because Congress allocates money annually for VA, this is a concern for Congress as well as for us taxpayers. What's notable here, and this is sort of the riddle we're trying to parse through, is the outcomes did not improve. So let me just sort of walk you through what I'm showing you here on this slide. This again goes back to Liam's paper using regression discontinuity. So in many regards, we're comparing the person who lived 39 miles versus those who lived 41 miles. Remember that the 41 mile people use more care, but we don't see that they're changing things like their mortality rate. And that's on the first column is all mortality rate. The second column is people with a high Charlson comorbidity index. These are the people we think are the sickest in the healthcare system. You can look at the priority groups. You can look at younger people in priority group 8. You can look at people with a PTSD disorder and people who are Medicare enrolled. And it's largely the same story. I should say, we're not going to show it here, but we looked at additional outcomes too. We've looked at post-operative mortality, readmissions from surgery, emergency department visits. And again, the story is very similar. So keep in mind, going back to that Axis scandal in 2014, where they found that approximately 35 veterans died while waiting for care, VA or the Congress responded, allocated all this money. We've been spending a lot of money, and we're not seeing an effect. Specifically on mortality and on other endpoints. And that's a concern. So this is Gene Yoon's study, also does not find an effect on mortality. So it's a different group of people, totally independent. We have not been working with them, and you can see that there. So again, it's replicating the results. So it's not just us, you might say. So I want to just reflect a moment on why no improved outcomes. You could immediately argue that this is a huge challenge, and I hope that you'll eventually get to there and say, I think this is a concern, but I will acknowledge that maybe we are measuring the wrong outcomes. Maybe we should ideally be measuring something like quality of life. It's really improving veterans' quality of life, and we just don't have good administrative data to measure quality of life. You could also argue that maybe there are some subgroups that really did improve and are getting swamped by the people who did not improve. That is a heterogeneous treatment effect story. We've done our best to test for that. And I was showing you, for example, back a few slides where we were looking at the high Charlson comorbidity index, and again, seeing no difference there. So I don't think it's a heterogeneous treatment effect. It's always possible, but I don't think it's there. And then maybe there were no improvements, and that is a least sort of interesting, but it's sort of a perplexing question. And this one reason we think that this could happen if veterans were shifting their payer. So what is payer shifting? So a veteran gets care in the community as they did before, but instead of using their other insurance, they use VA. So payer shifting really rests on a couple key ingredients. One is that veterans have to have dual insurance. You have to be able to say, I was getting care before under another insurer, and now I'm switching it to VA. So you have to have that dual coverage. You also have to have physicians who are willing to take VA payment. But because both Choice and Mission Act pinned VA payments on Medicare rates, there are a lot of physicians who are willing to accept Medicare rates and thus willing to accept VA payments. You also have to make an assumption that shifting is not harmful for veterans. If it's harmful, they wouldn't shift. And then probably you have to say that it's also advantageous for veterans, that it helps them on certain levels. And it could be as simple as something of convenience, but it could also be something like out-of-pocket costs. And typically, if you're looking at somebody, we don't always see out-of-pocket costs for private insurance or even Medicare. We don't see their Medigap, but usually VA is quite generous in their out-of-pockets for many veterans. So that's the story on payer shifting. And this, our team was really scratching our heads about this. And this is a paper that Liam did. I am not a co-author in this. Anita Avashi, who's an emergency medicine physician here and has been studying the CHOICE program and mission, and Susan Kirsch, Deputy Undersecretary for Dean, is on this as well. And let me just walk you through it. It could be a potentially complicated graph. So you have a dashed horizontal line. That's the implementation date of when the Mission Act came to be. And what you're going to have before that are sort of people's relative use of VA versus their Medicare emergency department use. So it's sort of the who's paying relative to each other and what's happened before and after the implementation of Mission. And what you're getting to see is that after the implementation of Mission, VA is increasingly paying these emergency department visits. And so you get to see that for the admitted, for all, and outpatient ED only. So that's the concern. It's faster for admitted, but it's not complete. So I will say this was great evidence. This gave us great pause. So kudos to Liam for that paper and Health Services Research. I would say it's intriguing, and I hope Liam would agree with me, but it's preliminary. So the study that they used was from New York, all payer claims data. So they knew it was comprehensive for the state of New York, but they only included inpatient and ED visits in that state. And New York's it's a big state ideally, but you'd like to have a number of other states to confirm this. And then making these projections is challenging because the population of veterans changes over time. And one of the challenges that we've been trying to figure out is to say, well, how big is this tip of this iceberg if it really exists in this payer shifting? And one way is that we started to think about doing this was pooling together insurance data from a number of public sources. So we started down that road. So it really gets to the, took me a while to get there, so I apologize, but to the crux of this study, which is how is insurance coverage among veterans changing? And I will say what we're going to be looking at here is all veterans. And we'll dice it up in many regards by enrollees versus non-enrollees, but we're going to use four surveys, three of which are national that the VA has nothing to do with. The first one is the National Health Interview Survey. This is a annual survey conducted by CDC. And you can see that it goes out to approximately 377,000, in our sample, it had 377,000 adults or 9% veterans. The next survey we're gonna use is the American Community Survey. This is done by the census each year. It's a very, very large survey. So we pulled those data. We ended up with 27 million adults, 8% were veterans. The last survey that we did was the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. This is also a CDC survey, and it's in combination between CDC and the states. And across the time span, we pulled together 4.6 million adults, 12% of whom were veterans. So those are the three national surveys. We then accessed this survey of enrollees. This is a survey that VA contracts a company to do each year to analyze the enrollee population and how that's changing. And we ended up with 535,000 adults, all of whom are not only veterans, but they're supposed to be enrollees in the system. I will make some, there's some caveats here too, right? So the surveys use different questions. And even some of these surveys, we're looking at a large time span here of 11 years. Some of the surveys even changed their questions a little bit during that time span. We worked to harmonize this as best as possible, but it's always hard. And one of the things that we like about multiple surveys is that you can not only understand some nuance, some questions were asked differently in one survey versus another survey, but allows you some level of triangulation and to try to figure out what's going on and is it consistent across the surveys. So analysis, there's no sophisticated, super hard analysis here. We are gonna use the survey weights that the national surveys provide. We did not run any regression models. So we did not wanna provide you with sort of conditional results or results that were sort of adjusted in a regression. We really wanted to provide you with sort of what we thought of as raw results. And they're very compelling. And the reason for doing that is that we're trying to really provide population level estimates, and we think that this does that. And in this talk, we're gonna give you is what we see as the top five findings from that data. So the first finding, you're gonna see that veterans are well insured. So this is a line graph that shows over the four different surveys over the course of the year that the lower one, the yellow one, is the survey enrollees. You can see the legend on the bottom. The blue is the American Community Survey. NHIS is the orange or reddish orange. And then the green is the Behavioral Risk Factor Survey. If you track the y-axis, you can see that a large percentage of veterans, the vast, vast majority, have some form of health insurance coverage. So in 2021, 96% of veterans had health insurance, any health insurance. You get to see some changes over time in the composition of these health insurance. So over time, you get to see a slight decrease in private insurance, a slight increase in Medicare insurance. This really just reflects that we've got a changing veteran population that's behind it, that changes actually quite notably over decades. So when I joined the VA in 1999, we were going through the World War II veterans. We're now out of the World War II veterans, we're into the Vietnam era veterans, but that's a large group of veterans. And so as those veterans age, you get to see private insurance decline, Medicare increase, for example. Eventually over time, the Vietnam veterans are gonna decrease in numbers and we're gonna end up with mostly the OEF, OIF and the Gulf War veterans in the samples. And any further conflicts will change that as well. So the other two findings I'm gonna just sort of lump together here, two and three, is most veterans do not report in the survey data that they enrolled in VA. And then 80% of VA enrollees have another source of insurance. So keep in mind, we talked about the ingredients you need for payer shifting. We're gonna see that 80% of VA enrollees are at least dual covered. So they're gonna have the ability to payer shift. So let's talk about these findings. So I have a table here. I'm just gonna focus on 2 years of, or 3 years of the data, which are 2019 to 2021. Just because there are some changes over time, and I don't want to sort of get into sort of are you confusing people with earlier data versus later data? So on the left-hand side is the overall statistics. In the middle columns are those not enrolled in VA, and the right-hand side are those who are enrolled in VA. So what you're going to see across the columns also is NHS, American Community Survey, and the survey of enrollees. So let's just talk about the overall statistics. For NHIS and ACS, about a third of those who took the survey report that they enrolled in VA. Now, the survey enrollees is supposed to be a survey of all enrollees. That largely plays out in what they report, but not perfectly. And then you get to see that there's some notable differences. Most of the time, the major differences happen to be with the survey enrollee survey data, not so much the difference between NHIS or ACS. About half of the veterans in the U.S. have private health insurance, fully expected. About half as well have Medicare. You also see TRICARE. TRICARE is for military retirees. And then you get to see the least common is Medicaid on the bottom row. So then you get to see the middle statistics. But let me focus you a little bit what's happening on the enrolled veterans. For many researchers who focus on VA data, this is where you typically focus. And so you're going to say, wow, according to your data, you have some variance here, but between NHIS and ACS, between 40% and 55% have private insurance. That is a lot of private insurance. About half of them, maybe a little bit more, depending on the survey data, have Medicare insurance. And then TRICARE is not inconsequential. About a third have TRICARE. So these are very well insured individuals in our system. Another feature we see is that there are some compositional changes in veterans over time. And here's probably the one that we think of the most common is a change in enrollment among women veterans. So the blue is men, and you get to see that if you go back to 2010, it was about 26% were enrolling, and that's gone up to about 35%. There was a notable difference in 2010 between men and women, and that has gone in a very narrowed fashion to 2020. So a changing face there between sort of in sex of the veterans. So the other thing that we see that's a very strong result from the data is veterans who enroll in VA are sicker and have fewer means than veterans who don't. And the NHIS data allow us some insights on what's going on. So we computed the reliance on VA by household income, and you'll get to see that the first row is those people who are fully reliant on VA, getting all of their care at VA. And you get to see that is most heavily, you know, over 50% in the group that has a household income of less than $35,000 per year. And it pretty much just changes monotonically until you get to non-reliant. And non-reliant, you get to see there are wealthier households are non-reliant. So you get to see this composition changes. Very similar story by health status. So you can see VA enrolled is the blue bars, and then private insurance is the orange bars. And as you go from excellent to poor, you get to see that those differences just disappear, if you will. So if you're in poor health, you're much more or much less likely to rely on private and much more likely to rely on VA and enroll in VA. So the other thing that we get to see, and this maybe is no surprise because I told you that any source of insurance coverage was very high, 96%, but it's uniformly good. And there are no marked disparities when you get into things like race or ethnicity. And we do a lot of, we have a lot of tables on this, but we can get into them. And across the board, VA is doing very well in terms of, or I should say veterans are doing very well in terms of their insurance coverage. Irrespective of their background. So one of the great things about the ACS is it's very large sample, such a large sample that we can even get into, you know, reasonably good estimates of people who are report being Asian and Hispanic. That's pretty unusual for many surveys, but that allows us to do that. We have other tables, if you so desire, with confidence intervals, if you're looking for the confidence intervals or the standard errors in here. But just for ease of presentation, we didn't present those. So there we do see variation in secondary insurance coverage. This is, you know, when you're doing unadjusted analysis, you have to draw the line at some point. We think a lot of this is probably likely driven by other factors. We didn't really want to get into a causal estimate of it, and our data really wouldn't support that anyway. But we see things like there's age of the population differs, and that obviously factors into whether you're Medicare eligible or not. Employment also really matters. So white non-Hispanic veterans had the highest rates of private insurance. We saw that. We saw white non-Hispanic, in comparison to white non-Hispanic veterans, blacks had higher rates of VA coverage and higher rates of Medicaid enrollment. And we also get to see some variance, just to be honest with you all, between the different surveys. But the difference between racial and ethnic groups in our characterization is quite low. Again, if you're really interested in those tables, we are more than happy to provide them to you. And here, just to give you a sample of the private insurance, is what you can see. Again, no standard errors or confidence intervals. We have those separately. But the first row is for white veterans, and you get to see the American Community Survey data. We talk about that most just because it's a much larger sample, and so we feel it has a little bit more reliability and less error. And you get to see, you know, relatively high over the majority, or I should say the majority, over 50% report some form of private insurance. And you can see those across the different race and ethnic groups. So for summary, so I sort of walked you through what we thought of as the top five findings from the survey data. There weren't any huge surprises for us. We had seen other data before that we knew that veterans were dual insured, but it drives it home that veterans have, almost all veterans have some form of health insurance, and the vast majority of veterans who enroll in the VA system have a second form, perhaps a third form of health insurance. Is a third form possible? Yes, because you could have private, you could have TRICARE, those are not mutually exclusive. And so you can really then choose who is your payer, if you will. My father-in-law is a veteran, and so you can easily talk to veterans about how they choose. And many veterans are very savvy in how they make these choices. So just to keep in mind that 80% of enrollees are covered by another health insurance plan. And this partly, you know, the high rates of Medicare coverage and the increasing rates of Medicare coverage partly reflects what we think of as this Medicare aging population, the graying of the veterans, and it's not done yet. We don't think of that population as through the system. And in fact, another 20% of the veteran population or enrollees will be eligible for Medicare in the next decade. So we're going through this large transition period right now, and we're gonna see more and more veterans enrolled in Medicare. And that really opens the sort of potentials for payer shifting. So I would say that payer shifting is still a valid concern. It can happen because most enrollees are well insured. The community physicians and providers are willing to accept VA payment. VA coverage is also relatively generous in terms of low copayment. So if you have a service-connected disability, if you're a veteran with a service-connected disability or a veteran with a means test, which means you pass an income threshold, you're eligible for no co-payments, in which case it's much easier to use VA as your payer rather than, for example, Medicare. The other thing is that we know that community care is convenient, and we've done other studies. There's a paper in Health Affairs with Megan Vanneman and Amy Rosen and myself and colleagues where we're looking at data. And the veterans like community care because it's so convenient. So they don't, for many of those folks, have to drive farther to get to VA. There's a community care hospital much closer. So we also think it's a valid concern given concerns that we need to expand purchase care more. So any legislation that does not consider this differential pricing is really at risk for not necessarily improving access. It could just be trying to transfer the payer from one payer to another payer. And I would say that we desperately need more evidence on the context surrounding payer shifting. And I, the four questions for me really are, who's payer shifting? Sort of which veterans are doing this? On what services are they payer shifting? In Liam's paper in health services research, they looked at emergency care and some other stuff, but we need more context there to understand what's happening there. When is the payer shifting happening? And then ideally, we'd like to know some mechanisms of why. Is it driven by convenience? Is it driven by other factors? In part because VA has now set up a new center that David O is the acting director of. And it's the Center for Care and Payment Innovation. It's modeled after the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Innovation Center, CMMI. And they're particularly interested in these issues, but they really need more evidence to drive those decisions. And it's not like we can just eliminate payer shifting. Some of these veterans who are using community care are really benefiting from it. They don't have a second payer. And so we don't want to just turn it off the access. We need to be very thoughtful about what this access looks like and how to sort of regulate it and be careful about it. The other thing to think about is payer shifting bad? And I really want to be careful here to say, if I mentioned my father-in-law is a veteran, to most veterans, they should be thinking about what's beneficial to them and reducing their out-of-pocket costs, using care that's high quality and convenient is what I think they should be focused on. So it can be very beneficial for veterans. But for VA, it paints a very different story. From a policy perspective, it's not optimal. So unlike Medicare, VA faces an annual budget that is set by Congress each year. We are, by all accounts, exceeding our budget this year. And so what is that causing? Well, that's causing this rapid belt tightening. This is causing people to say hiring freezes. We need to think about, stopping doing X, Y, and Z, without really thinking about whether what we're stopping is high value. And that scenario has played out in the past. We have seen pressures to sort of get out of the business of providing substance use treatment, even though we know substance use treatment is cost effective. In part because when you provide substance use treatment, the returns really don't go to the healthcare system, they go to criminal justice. So I would say that I'm already seeing evidence that this is happening today, that we're rapidly trying to constrain our spending. And so it makes me very concerned that we're going to be cutting high value programs in an effort just to save a dollar. And I think that's a bad thing, but that's probably being driven by payer shifting. So I would also say that VA lacks the same tools to improve value that Medicare uses. So right now, about 90% of Medicare dollars are in some form of value-based purchasing agreement or managed care. And right now, VA does not currently engage in selective contracting. And this is really, when I said earlier that I had a disclaimer, I really want to bring that up. These are my perspectives, not on VA, is that I think community care contracts are a bad deal right now for VA. They are encouraging any willing provider, anybody that the VA, the veteran wants, as long as they're not redlined by CMS. And all of these contracts, I think that the VA is holding the majority, if not all, of the financial risk. And I think, again, that's bad. It's not sort of like bundled payments. None of that's going on. So, VA is really absorbing this cost. I think VA really needs to explore and adopt what I think of as managed care tools, sort of narrowing the network, if you will, trying to think about utilization review, prior authorization would be, very typical managed care tools, and do so in a very smart way, where it's learning from the evidence. But without it, I really worry that VA is just going to go bankrupt, as that report mentioned with Ken Kaiser. So looking into the future. So Like I said, recently set up is the Center for Care and Payment Innovation. David O is the acting director for that. That's the website. And this was established with authority under the Mission Act. This is the VA center that's really got the authority to think about how do we vary these parameters. Obviously, the Office for Integrated Veterans Care, which runs Community Care Program, is very close partnerships with CCPI because they were very sort of focused in on some of these issues as they relate to community care. The other thing that I feel very strongly about is we need to think about how we measure access. And I so wish the VA would stop measuring access with wait times. Wait times is not an evidence-based issue. It makes people think that faster waits are better. Of course, if you're buying stuff off of Amazon and you want it delivered with Prime, that's a great thing and you can pay for it. But for healthcare, that's just not high delivery of services. As I've gotten older, I've helped my family navigate, some very serious health issues. And you just realize that wait times are, unless it's emergent, are very standard when you need specialty care procedures. And it's correlated in many regards with sort of the quality of the services that you're getting and the provider that you're trying to get care from. So I'm really nervous when people say wait time should be zero or close to zero. To me, that just is not sustainable, either clinically or financially. So I think we need to think about what are the right access metrics there. I'll get off the soapbox at that point, but you get to hear why that's not speaking for VA right there. So the other thing is that I'm really pleased to see that VA is what we think of as part of the safety net. So in 1996, Ken Kaiser wrote this paper that was in Health Affairs that talked about VA as being sort of a hidden part of the safety net. And it really is. And in many regards, it is working the way that it's supposed to work. It is picking up and helping people who are low income. It is really helping people who are sicker. And that is terrific. And I think that's a great role for VA. I think that there are some holes right now in that safety net. And you can really see these if you dive more deeply. And Congress is starting to look at this as well. So some veterans without health insurance may not be eligible for VA benefits. We see this with people, for veterans who are unhoused. If you were left the military in a less than honorable way, and are unhoused, you may not be and you're sort of eligible for any of these benefits. Even if the reason you left the military dishonorably, so unquote unquote, was because of something that happened in the military. And so we're starting to see this getting chipped away. One of the areas that is getting chipped away is the Compact Act, which I mentioned. This is for veterans who present at any hospital in psychiatric distress. The VA was responsible for them. So in the past, VA was just responsible for enrollees, but now we're starting to see maybe VA is responsible for this bigger population. Personally, again, personal statement, I really like the idea that VA should be thinking about veterans as a population, not just VA enrollees. And so for me, I like the idea of thinking about who are we managing, how do we help them get care, whether it's through their private insurance, if that's who they want to get care from, or from VA, versus this, what I think of it in many regards is an oddity, which is sort of like, are they enrolling, which is in function of how well do they know the system that they can even enroll. So that's one of another area that I think that this is sort of a mixed bag, a safety net. I think that in many regards, VA is doing well. I think that Congress will keep an eye out to this in the next couple of years. So I suspect we have some questions and people might challenge a lot of what I just said. But first off, thank you so much for attending. We have about 15 minutes for questions. We have Liam Rose on the line. He is the lead author. In addition to providing support and working with me and being a tremendous teammate and colleague, he is the lead author on the payer shifting paper. So he might be able to better address those questions. So, Liam, what kind of questions do we have?
We don't have many right now. I just imagine the audience all nodding in agreement with everything you said. But
So, hey, maybe you can editorialize a little on
we do have one.
your view on it.
So this is a good question. I think you can maybe speculate where the person is asking if you have any evidence or speculation about whether enrollees use VA versus community care for different types of healthcare. And how might that might affect these concerns about growing community care expenses. And they give the example that more inclined to seek VA for service-related conditions rather than their general health conditions?
So we have a veterans engagement panel here as part of our Center of Innovation, and we recently presented this work to them. And they, you know, these are folks who really believe in VA, veterans who really believe in VA, and their take on it was that they tend to use VA for everything, and they said that they also feel lucky that they come to the Palo Alto VA, which they think of as the crown jewel of VAs. But they use community care when VA doesn't provide the service. And they mentioned things like cardiac rehab was one of the things, and they mentioned something else. And they said, but by and large, we get all of our other care. And then they paused and they said, yeah, but that's not completely true. One of the veterans says, I've been feeling depressed recently because one of my medical conditions flared, and I would like to get mental health counseling. But the system seems taxed. And if I am willing to say I'm suicidal, I'll get seen the same day. If I'm not, it seems like a very long wait to get counseling. And so there are some real nuance here on how do we build a system that is responsive to services and thinks about buying services when there are gaps in VA coverage versus how to navigate sort of access. And I'm gonna pose a question to you, Liam. How do you think about that? And help answer that question.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, so for there's only limited pieces of evidence, right, where you have the paper when you were looking at the cataracts and outpatient surgeries and saw that people would sometimes go further than their VA.
That is correct. We did a study where we were looking at cataracts and drive times, and we found people who were eligible for community care. They got a community care-based cataract surgery, and they drove farther to that community, that cataract provider, than they would have had to drive to the VA.
Yes. And then when we look at acute care, we see that they go much closer. And that obviously makes sense. But my speculation right now, and we're working on more stuff, and I'd like to know more, is that it's very location specific. Also getting information from the Veteran Council in areas where there's only a CBOC, only a VA outpatient clinic. Palo Alto is quite far, but those areas, it's very well correlated. If it's far, generally, if you're far from a VA, you're also in an area where there isn't good outside access as well. So this also gets into this wait time debate a little bit, where, there's been some work for people showing that the wait times are similar, especially for things like specialty care, where if you live in a more rural area, the VA may be 2 hours away, but your closest cardiologist is also 2 hours away. So it can be, I think there's a lot more work to be done. And as far as the specific question in terms of service-related conditions, I'm not sure. I'd like to understand that better, I think. I don't have an answer for it right now.
Okay. I think there's a lot of questions. Your paper in health services research was very well done and provocative. And I think that we just need more evidence to figure out how to guide CCPI and IBC and helping them deal with this. My fear is that VA is going to go bankrupt before that happens. And I know that people will joke that VA can't go bankrupt. Well, Congress taxpayers are going to eventually stop wanting to fund these increases. And then the question is, do you spend the money on purchase care or do you spend the money on care that we make and provide? Well, you have to run these hospitals. That's a lot of money. So if a lot of the money goes right to the facility to run the hospitals. So then you're going to have to start closing outpatient clinics. Well, that seems crazy too. So at some point, someone's got to pay the bill.
So we have questions rolling in now, so you might have to be a little quicker. So one person said, and I think this is a really good point, it's amazing how many veterans don't know they're eligible for VA care. They think it's someone that's only injured in combat. I'll put out the statistic that only 1% of veterans are actually injured in combat these days for more recent veterans. So the vast majority of VA enrollees are not injured in combat at all. And the statement further says that they don't understand how to optimize all their healthcare options, VA and non-VA options. So there's no question on it, but I think it is an interesting thing to discuss about how little information there often is about these things.
That's true. And that's why I worry that your paper in health services research is really just the tip of the iceberg. So we think of Medicare as spending more on veterans each year than VA spends on veterans. So if we're worried about payer shifting, there's a lot of sort of financial risks that VA could be absorbing here.
Yeah. So the next one, this just goes back to the older paper. The mortality outcomes data you showed earlier, you stated that only about 35 veteran enrollees died while waiting for care. I should note that that's actually from the wait times scandal from Phoenix 2014, not from the paper. Did you look at veterans who applied for VA healthcare but died before they were enrolled, died while waiting to be enrolled in VA, which is different from the appointment wait time issue? Past VA reports indicate 300,000 veterans were in pending enrollment status when they died. I think this is a great question, if I can answer this real quick. This is an older report. Nowadays, every single veteran who served recently is eligible for priority group 6 immediately for 5 years. So now that they have changed that, anyone who served in the Gulf time period, it counts.
That's right. And the person mentioned earlier, you mentioned the question about like that they don't know that they're eligible. Well, everybody now is eligible when they leave a recent conflict.
Yes. And I will also, this is also a good question because no, we do not know the actual number of veterans that are waiting to be enrolled because this also is a little bit of an issue between VBA and VHA. Where VHA, you can be enrolled quite quickly. You can show up. Whereas VBA will take a process.
Thanks for answering that.
Next one. Drive times is definitely improvement from mileage. This is, in case anyone misses what I'm saying here, they updated it from 40 miles. And then with the Mission Act, they made it drive time. Because a lot of people complain, 20 miles in a city can take you a very long time. So then this person is saying, but when we think about veterans with disabilities, 40 or 60 miles is still a very long way. I know a lot of care is available virtually now, but not everything can be done virtually. How do you think this affects the issues brought up? And do you think there's any kind of resolution? Great question.
Yeah, so my answer there is, I think we need more evidence specifically on veterans who use the system because of disability. The person who raised this is completely correct that drive times is not standard for everybody. It means that you have a car and you can use the car. And for many veterans, they don't have a car. Others are disabled and either they use a car or they rely on transportation to get them places. And so we need to understand sort of the nuance and what this means for those folks there. There's just no replacing it, better evidence.
Okay, and then the next question is, we know that veterans as a population are highly conscientious and especially are concerned about the welfare of fellow veterans. Is there any systematic evidence about how veterans' perceptions of VA utilizations and wait times might be affecting their decisions to seek community care? I adore that question, by the way.
I knew too. I don't know of any data that suggests it, but it suggests that there's an altruism, which I've seen it completely. And I've talked to veterans because we've done clinical trials and they jump at the chance to enroll in a clinical trial because they want to help other veterans. And I don't know if they know that pushing for earlier care has an externality effect. Externality is sort of a lingo for an economist, that it could be affecting other veterans.
I love that question too, because I think the answer is no, there is no systematic evidence. And I think there should be. It's a difficult question to ask, but I think, things like survey experiments or, qualitative research would definitely help there. Okay, so the next question, did you identify certain services where veterans are more likely to access care elsewhere than the VA? And if yes, are there any solutions in the pipeline to make these services more attractive to veterans? So we did look at a couple of things at our earlier choice paper, I'm not sure there's a whole lot about the mission period right now. I will also cite another paper that one of your colleagues did, Todd, the primary care paper, where basically it went from 1% primary care to 2% primary care and community care. So the vast majority of primary care is still coming from VA provided rather than community care, but it is growing quite quickly. And then the other things we looked at include things like mental health, outpatient surgical services, those kind of things.
Yeah.
We tried to nail it down as much as we can, but I don't think we have too much time to get into the specific ones right now.
And a lot of the knowledge is very contextualized. So you have to know that, for example, they lost a radiologist or a CT surgeon at a site, and so they don't have the capacity to do X, Y, or Z there. And often we just don't know that unless we're talking to individuals at each of these sites. And you really, to make that into sort of analyses like we're doing, you need to know this timing and the site. That makes it really important.
Okay.
One other thing, just to toot your horn, Liam, is most of your work has been on emergency care recently with the Mission Act, in part because that's been such a large spend. And there's been a lot of challenges about, like, how do you encourage appropriate use of emergency care? And I just to note that this is not a problem that VA faces alone. If people have been following the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, Amy Finkelstein's work there suggests that even when you expand Medicaid, they continue, the people who get insurance coverage continue to use the emergency room. So it becomes a very convenient, easy way to access many services. And so VA is not alone in trying to struggle with how to get appropriate use of that service.
Yeah. I'll just make one final note on that question. From the Choice Era paper, our largest and the biggest increase, so they're more likely to access care elsewhere than VA, it was for psychotherapy, CPT codes, so mental health. That was the biggest increase we found. But again, that was choice and mission may be different. Wow, okay, we're coming to the end here. What are some, you said no wait times. The question is, what are some recommended ways to measure access to care other than wait times?
Yeah, that's, and I gave a couple. Well, so we typically think of it, not me, but the world out there right now in American healthcare system is using a lot of selective contracting where they're building narrow networks, hopefully not too narrow. There's been a lot of papers by folks like Jane Zhu and Dan Polsky at Health Affairs talking about narrow networks. So in some sense, what you would want to do is think about building narrow networks that would help serve the veterans. And then you'd have utilization review to make sure that you've got appropriate use of those services. Right now, we've got these things called SEOCs, standardized episodes of care, which make the billing easier, but there's not a transfer of financial risk. And so we'd also want to think about transferring some financial risk to the insurer, much like managed care does, such that if they provide them a lot of services, ongoing services that aren't necessary, that's on their dime, not on our dime. What would you say on that one, Liam?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question. I think it's not a one-size-fits-all answer, and that's the real problem. I think the wait times one is an issue because, you know, not everything needs to be urgent. And a lot of appointments are not built to be soon as possible. But yeah, I don't have a great answer.
I would also say one last comment on wait times. VA is the only system that provides that data. So if you're trying to make an informed decision, you only have half of the equation, and then you have to start calling providers to figure out what the wait time is on that side. And lo and behold, in my personal experience, is the people who can see you quickly, you're not really sure you want to go to them for different reasons, that, you know, quality metrics, that type stuff. So people you think of as being top people often have 6-8 month wait lists. So, you know, wait time is very common in non-emergent services.
We're at the top of the hour. Let's see.
Sorry. I appreciate all these
Okay,
questions.
one more comment, which I've also heard this one. I just want to bring this one up. We've heard a number of stories of patients who are drive time eligible who wind up getting care at the academic affiliate across the street from the VA.
Yeah, we've heard the same stories. Great comment. I don't know the answer to that one.
So we're just about out of time, guys.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Liam, and thank you, Rob. Thanks for hosting.
I don't know if I got to every question. I tried. So if there's any more, feel free to email Todd or myself.
Yes, thank you all.
Todd, T-O-D-D dot Wagner, W-A-G-N-E-R at va.gov, and Liam, L-I-A-M dot Rose, R-O-S-E at va.gov.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the webinar momentarily. A short survey will pop up. Please do take a few moments and provide those answers to those questions. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Rob.